From the classroom to the emergency room, OR and beyond, you're joining Trauma ICU Rounds with your host, Dr. Dennis Kim.
So we are here at the AAST 2022 meeting. We're here with a number of friends, colleagues, and this particular individual that many of you will know, Dr. Brian A. Cotton. And I've got my buddy, Neil Perry, here from Canada. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening at the AAST. BAC, let's hear from him.
Late night last night, about 4, 4:30, closing it down at the Cotton Pop-Up Bar here. Some good stuff on the agenda, on the program here. What have we had? I mean, the two things that stand out to me are things that have always been near and dear to my heart, which is female blood products. And you got two things out of Colorado coming right now. You got one looking at better resuscitation, better coagulation profiles with female products. Stop with the, oh my God, it's females, they're bad, and females can't donate plasma and all that bullshit. Female plasma, female cryo, we're actually seeing might be actually a better product. We looked at it at our place, green plasma, superior product when females on oral contraceptives. Let's get past all this bullshit of trolley and you know, multiparous female donors. They actually might be the key to being a better resuscitation product, a better hemostatic profile.
So for so many years during our training, our residencies, we've been told the risk of trolley is so much more increased with female donors. What is the experience that you're having? You guys are leading the way when it comes to the use of things like whole blood. What's the holdup? And what are the next steps in terms of where we go from here?
I think there's a couple parts to your question there. And I think the first part that I think is critical is we got into this, oh my God, female donors are bad. And yeah, you got six kids and you've had multiple antibody crossing. I'm not naming anybody, my wife. And multi-porous females should probably not be donating. Okay, fine. However, a nulliparous female donor or a just pregnant female donor, a college female on oral contraceptives, why can't they donate? They have a hemostatic profile that's absolutely superior to a male donor or a female that's not on oral contraceptives. So why not actually engage those donors and bring those donors in? So that's something we got to get past. And I hope the two presentations out of Colorado at this meeting will kind of start pushing things and moving that back in that direction. As far as whole blood, again, the coolest thing I saw out of whole blood, other than, again, I'm going to, you know, plug for my fellow here, Justin Gerard, with the pediatric whole blood experience. We've shown it's safe in kids. We've shown low titer, low anti-A, low anti-B is safe. It's good. Less blood products, higher survival. Why the hell not? You know, and we got something that's on. It's going to be at East. You're going to see here, as well as the early data coming out of Lights showing that head injuries, as much as a bane of our existence, they are in hemorrhagic shock, may actually benefit if they're TBI and hemorrhagic shock from getting whole blood, which is uncommon. And then finally, the other one we just saw here as well, which is today's, was leukoreduction. Because, oh my God, hand waving, oh my God, leukoreduction, we got to leukoreduce it, blah, blah. It's all bullshit, right? And in trauma, right, because in trauma patients, their immune system is completely downshifted in trying to stop clotting and start bleeding. They don't give a shit about the immunosuppression part. They don't care about that. Your body doesn't care about it. And the leukoreduction is not as big of a deal as a bone marrow transplant. Fine, leukoreduce it. But in a goddamn bleeding to death trauma patient, that's all been downregulated and shifted over to trying to stop bleeding and stop and clot, it doesn't matter. In fact, they showed at a study today that the leukoreduction actually increased the amount of blood products you get, less hemostatic benefit, and maybe a mortality increase by doing leukoreduction. So leukoreduction may not be the key. And again, I think that's been holding back a lot of people in switching to whole blood, because most people that I've gone and given talks about whole blood on are on board with whole blood. They just can't get it because of their blood bankers. They're not anti-whole blood. They're just like, yeah, we can't get it. But again, you know, the blood bankers have got a system, right? They take it, they chop it up, just like a street thug steals the car, chops it up, sells it for parts, makes more money. They can chop it up, sell it for parts, not just make more money. I'm not trying to bust on them for that, but they can also help the anemic patient, help the coagulopathic, help the bone marrow transplant with some platelets. They can break it up. It's part of their normal system. And whole blood, kind of like streaming off and like having a side you know, supply chain is kind of throwing them off a little bit, and a lot of them don't want to like go down that pathway. And again, there's also supply issues about expiration and stuff like that.
So in the last couple of years, we've seen so much about TEG. We've seen a lot of research and data come out about TXA. I got to ask you, how helpful is that? And then in terms of adjuncts, calcium, what's the latest in terms of calcium use in bleeding trauma patients?
So I'll start with the first question, which was kind of a TXA related thing. And again, so we in Denver and a few other places are very much TEG guided resuscitation of our TXA. If our TEG's a little bit jacked, even the least bit, like the normal range on a rapid TEG is 0 to 7.5%. If they get just even that 3%, we're ready to like start giving them TXA. So I'm a believer that it's a nice adjunct. I don't know how much of a great adjunct it is without, good resuscitation. If you've got shit resuscitation, I do not think that TXA is all that. Now, if you're in the middle of nowhere, again, let's go back to crash two. You're in the middle of nowhere, austere environment, and that's all you got, give a syringe of TXA. There's something going on with it though, because TXA, if you look at the crash two study even, it did not reduce blood transfusions. The people that got placebo and got TXA, even if they had a better survival, there was no difference in transfusions. So it's something else that's modulating. And again, I'm not discounting it. I'm not shitting on that. There's something it's doing, but it's not hemostatic as like the way that we think. So I do believe it. I'm more of a stamp guy. So the stamp trial, a lot more information there, a lot more like U.S. based resuscitation type strategies. And again, it showed again, early TXA giving that might have a benefit, but it really showed it in a very distinct population. And besides the TEG guided resuscitation for us to give TXA, the only one that we really got a hard press for is the ones that are in profound shock. So both crash two and stamp said less than 70, 75 systolic on arrival, go ahead and give it. So if we got it, we give it. Now, if you look at the kallikrein, the bradykinin and all the UP, all that bullshit going on in the system, systematically giving TXA a 1 gram and a 1 gram slow thing is not going to take it. You need to overwhelm it. We give 2 to 3 grams when we give it in the OR. You've got to go big on it. You got to overwhelm it because we know late TXA sucks. Late TXA is harmful. So we got to give a big dose up front. And I'm a complete believer in that. I think the Sperry stuff coming out from the stamp trial is fantastic on that. Now, your next question was calcium. Calcium, we're literally looking at that right now. We're excited about it. I cannot wait to like look at what our results are, and hopefully we'll see what happens with Western Trauma on that or an upcoming meeting. I think it's an understudied, not only as a reversal of vasoplegia, but also to address the giant fucking sink that is the citrate that all these blood products are suspended in. Now, I hope we haven't done a run our data yet. I hope that when we look at it, whole blood, because it's less citrate solution because of one unit versus 111 in a component therapy. I'm hoping that whole blood will show it's a better product and less citrate sink than 1:1:1. That said, we are not doing a good job with it. I would like to have calcium taped to every like cooler product coming up the pipe and be delivering it. I'd like to give it pre-hospital. I will tell you that's one thing that even in our place, we are not as good as we want to be on it. Our pre-hospital groups have done a good job of it. I would like to actually have it taped. The problem in our hospital is it's all siloed financially. And so the blood bank doesn't want to purchase the calcium and the pharmacy doesn't want to give the calcium to the blood bank. And so no one wants to cooperate, but I think absolutely. So as a vasoplegic reversal and as a way to address the shit show that is the coagulation issues with citrate, I think it absolutely calcium is the way to go. And we're going to be looking at that. I know LIGHTS, the Jason Sperry multi-center DOD funded stuff is going to be actually looking at that in a pre-hospital study for calcium here soon. I cannot wait to hopefully be involved in that.
I go to Canada and we don't have things like whole blood. And so we need to get another perspective. I would love to hear from my friend, Dr. Neil Perry. Do you agree with BAC when he talks about the use of TXA and calcium, which are probably two of the more sort of controversial issues that have come up in the last couple of years? What are we doing here in Canada, Dr. Perry?
I thought we were going to be talking about bourbon tonight. So that's okay. We're talking and consuming bourbon as we do this. And the Canadian Blood Services, it seems to be that's a bit of our limiting step. As we know, there are a few people that are really trying to push to get whole blood. Andrew Beckett, who's in Toronto and at St. Mike's and our president of TAC, has been instrumental in trying to push to get whole blood. But I think we're still a ways off from that. I really do. Like, we're a ways off from prime time for whole blood, which is a shame. As far as what Brian was saying about the different components and the cost and all that, I haven't spoken to Canadian Blood Services per se on this. I don't know exactly how it's all going to pan out, but I think that's a big issue for sure, the business behind it all. Recently in Canada now, in Ontario, or I think through the whole country, actually. Prior, it was always volunteering to give blood. You weren't paid to donate blood. Now they're actually contracting out companies to get plasma. So we'll see how all of this goes, if we can contract out and you can get whole blood, and whether that works or not, that may be. And then the other comments you asked about, if whether I agreed with Cotton over here about everything, yes.
It's just because I'm filling his glass.
Just to add on to the Canadian content here. So some of the things we've learned with looking at adjuncts for resuscitation, so some of the fibrinogen and the various concentrates. So right now, Canadian Blood Services has to contract that to a third party, and the cost of that is actually quite high. So when we look at our resuscitation strategy, so we have our, you know, with the various compounds and they, you know, the chop shop that Cotton likes to talk about, and that is quite expensive, but these other products are expensive as well. We're trying to, you know, I think having more, whether it's Rotem or TAG or whatever it is, will let us tailor what we're doing a little bit better. We're trying to work on that in Edmonton specifically. And, you know, our group in Edmonton, we have our trauma is maybe 5 to 10% of, say, the patients that need blood products, but we are a very high proportion of the massive transfusion use, just because that's the nature of our group, and we have a really high plasma use. So we have our, you know, AB plasma users, and, you know, whether or not we're going to use just A plasma, those kind of things, but just what's our availability and how are we actually accessing the products as in a donor system where we don't pay people. So I think this becomes a big issue from a TXA standpoint. And I, you know, I remember being a really, really big TXA proponent. And then I go to Texas and I'm with Cotton, who doesn't really think a lot about pre-hospital TXA. And I remember being there and we had TAG, and, you know, I could count on two hands the number of patients that actually needed TXA based on our TAG. But this is urban trauma. Helicopters are going out, picking up the patients off the road. 20 minutes later, they're in our trauma bay. That is not my population in Edmonton when I have people coming in 18 hours away. So, you know, are our patients a little bit different? Where do we fit in on the crash trial? So is the TXA in the field great? Is it overkill? I think we have a lot to learn, and hopefully having more access to things like Rotem or TAG in our trauma centers will let us better tailor our resuscitation, and this is going to be good for our patients, it's going to be good for our system, and it's going to help us deal with the limited resource that we have in the context of our blood banks.
There we are.
Hey.
Phoenix.
Okay. Yeah.
Phoenix.
That's right.
Different state, different practice program. What are you
doing? I think whole blood's compelling. My biggest issue with it is there seems to be sort of a limit to how much whole blood we can give a patient for regulatory issues. And, you know, it's not really universal donor, because even though it might be universal donor from the red cell point of view, it's not from the AB plasma point of view. So if a patient is needing a true massive transfusion, are those 2 to 4 to 6 units of whole blood making much of a difference on the front end? And if they don't need a massive transfusion, they only need, you know, maybe 6 to 8 units of blood, probably component therapy would get them through just the same. So, but what I find compelling about whole blood is the platelets. And I wonder about cold stored platelets. There's evidence that they're more efficacious than the room temperature platelets that we conventionally use. So that's kind of what I'm very interested in, and I wonder if we should really be giving cold stored platelets in routine fashion in a massive transfusion setting. So, you know, multiple cold stored platelet units as the transfusion goes on, 20, 30 units of red cells.
So I'll ask you, are you starting with a plasma first resuscitation?
In Phoenix, we are doing that. We are doing one-to-one in the trauma bay, thawed plasma to red cells. We have 8 units of red cells and 8 units of thawed plasma ready to go. And that's when we initiate massive transfusion, that's what we give. So yeah, I agree. I think that's an important thing, and that's what we're doing. I think calcium's important. I think calcium in my center is largely driven by anesthesia during, because we're operating on the patient and they're the ones giving the products, etc. Our trauma anesthesiologists are pretty heavy on the calcium, and I haven't studied this yet, but anecdotally, I think, you know, they come out well resuscitated, and I think that's a big part of it. So that's something I think we need to look at.
Yeah, I think Jordan like perfectly described some of the questions and issues with whole blood, because again, a lot of places are nailing down the, like, how much whole blood you get, how much it matters. Because again, if you look at combat, that was out of Denver, short transport times, versus Pamper. Pamper found a benefit of early plasma. Combat did not. But Combat, they were showing up with, like you were talking about, maybe they were getting one unit in. Sometimes they were hanging the first unit as they pulled up into the bay in Denver. So there's a big difference in the transport times. And that gets back to Nori Bradley's comments about transport and TXA and in austere environments. I think that's all relevant. Right, and you don't know the timing sometimes. But I think it's real to talk about how much whole blood and what it makes an impact in. I'll tell you, in our studies and our early data, giving whole blood seems to kind of like dampen down the amount of total products you give, which is, I think, is a winner, but is just a couple of units of benefit. And I think that's a very, very good question that Weinberg brought up. I still feel that it makes a difference early on, that just getting exposure to it is a big deal. Now, to pivot to your cold stored platelets, we was talking about cold stored platelets. Again, you've got, even though we've always been taught, oh my God, you can't put them on cold and ice. It's good. Oh my God, dogs and cats living together, complete chaos, right? Ghostbusters reference. Okay. Anyway, so the cold is going to be bad for the platelets. It's not. It clumps them. The platelet count drops, but the thrombin generation, the activity of those platelets, the lifespan of those platelets all gets better. In fact, you can actually, it's not just 7 to 10 days in those platelets at room temperature. With cold store, you can go out even farther because you drop the metabolic rate, you drop the glycolysis, you drop the metabolism of the platelets, and they can actually, once they're warmed up and put into a patient, they can actually work longer. So there's a lot of positive things about that. Yeah, Nori.
So Cotton, you're talking about the impact of the platelets with cold storage, and I know you guys have done some work looking at what happens in the rapid transfuser, and it seems like when we throw them in the Belmont, something different happens to the platelets. So how does that impact with the cold storage?
So we haven't looked at it on the cold blood, the cold platelets yet, but when we looked at the whole blood, platelet count plummeted. However, it still stayed around 100,000, and they were better. They were like, it's screening out the weak sperm, and you're getting the strong ones that are surviving, right? The ones that make it to it, only the strong survive, right? The platelet activity was superb. The thrombin generation, the time to peak thrombin generation, all the platelet activity, you look at AA or ADP and all that kind of shit, all those on multiplate, everything got better by going through the Belmont or stayed the same. It either didn't get worse or get better by going through the Belmont, almost like it activated things. That said, the platelet count absolutely did drop. Because it clumps, it takes out, again, the weak ones, the large ones, and they get screened out with the filter, which is what Nori was bringing up. I suspect cold sore platelets will be very, very similar.
Just to kind of bring in a comment to what Jordan was saying, you know, we're looking at how we're doing our resuscitation. And I think one of the big things I took away from Texas and being there was when we talk about one-to-one resuscitation, it's like, well, 1-to-1-to-1 is the start of resuscitation, not the end. And I feel like a lot of the times in Canada when we're, you know, we start with our 4 units of pack cells and whether it's 2 to 4 of FFP and eventually some platelets, and we're hoping it balances out eventually. But when I was in Houston and in the trauma bay and the nurses are coming in, like, do you want 1-in-1 or do you want whole blood? I mean, this is just like Christmas, right? Like everything they bring in, this is all bonus. But, you know, it was never, do you want blood? It was always, do you want 1-in-1? Because we started with a balanced resuscitation. And I think that's something that, you know, we can strive for. And whether we have thawed plasma and, you know, there's going to be different sites that have different resuscitation strategies. But how do we try to achieve that balance earlier rather than just hoping it comes out in the wash at the end? And I think that's a big thing to think about. It's the start of the resuscitation, not the end.
As we talk about all this and as I think about where I am now, I'm on an island, and we very rarely will activate an MHP or MTP, and platelets seem to be one of the rate-limiting factors when it comes to trying to perform a 1-to-1-to-1, and plasma. We do not have thawed plasma ready to go. We've been writing and talking about lyophilized plasma for years. You look at the Journal of Trauma, we've talked about lyophilized plasma. Are we there yet? Like, are we going to move towards lyophilized plasma? And then I would love to hear, what's the role of prothrombin complex concentrate? Should we be looking at that as an adjunct? What's the role of fibrinogen concentrate?
Let's go back a little bit. And I do think what Nori brought up about the product timing, and it's something that Jordan and taking it back to Fabian brought up when we were planning proper, which is the timing of the platelets and the timing of the products. Because a lot of people, especially people that go, we still think proper was a success and 1-to-1-to-2 outperformed at historical performance because of how early the platelets were going. The platelets were coming in earlier. It wasn't six red cells, then 3 plasma, then 1 platelet. It was kind of a 2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1. So there's a lot of that early balancing, even in a 2-to-1 fashion, that I think is critical. It's also about timing. Because when Dave Meyer, who's one of my partners, one of our former fellows, now one of my partners, was looking at it, it didn't matter about the ratios as much as the timing. Every 60-second delay in getting blood products to the bedside increased your mortality by 5%. 5% increase every 60 seconds. So, and again, that was saying regardless of 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. So I think that's a big deal to look at, and I think the timing of it is a big deal. I think platelets are huge. I got Josh Brown behind me pulling off his best Chris Pratt imitation. He's pulling some wild turkey rare breed right now. If he wants to chime in, he can talk. However, I think there's a lot of it about the early resuscitation that's key. All right. So plasma. So when I have a patient that I think is, oh fuck, bleeding to death, they're getting whole blood. If I can hear the bleeding, it's whole blood. If I'm like, yeah, maybe he's just drunk or high, I don't know, plasma first. And here's why. Plasma, not PCCs, not concentrates and whatever. Plasma, best acid-base buffer on the fucking planet. Best volume expander, oncotic agent, endothelial stabilizer. Oh, and it's got some kick-ass clotting factors. It's not perfect, but my God, it's pretty goddamn good. PCCs are directed. It's precision medicine. It's awesome. But am I going to have to team that with some shitty crystalloid as a volume expander to make up? Because again, they need coagulation factors. I think the PCCs are awesome at that, but they don't provide that volume expansion. And so why would I give concentrated PCCs and some shitty salt water versus just giving plasma? That's at least my argument. And again, I don't know if Jordan wants to chime in. If Josh wants to chime in, it's just, to me, that's my bias for plasma versus PCCs and saline.
I think what you said about the timing is so key. And so my resident that's presenting tomorrow, We combined Pamper patients and Stamp patients. And what we showed was, didn't matter if you got pack cells, plasma, TXA, it was how long it was the time to initiate that resuscitation. So all of them, we looked at them separately, we looked at them combined. We said if you got it in the field, if you got it within the first 90 minutes of the trauma center, the time to this critical intervention was what mattered. And so, you know, if you're in a system where it's 40 minutes to the trauma center, you got to start in the field. If you're in a system where it's 5 minutes to trauma center, get them to the trauma center and we'll start it there. And so it's really the time to initiate that resuscitation, blood products, adjuncts, that makes a difference.
Timing, yeah. Timing's key. So in Ontario with our flight paramedics with Orange, we now have blood. We've done a little trial. We're getting blood on the flights, able to do that. Prior to that, if there was a modified scene, so on scene, the helicopter lands on scene, they're actually having the police go to the nearest hospital, bring blood to them. So I totally agree. I think time is really paramount, and we'll find out how this plays out as more of the data comes out.
So I'm really excited about this, and I love this concept, and I wonder how I can make it actionable, because, you know, we have cases where our transfer time is 18 hours. So my catchment area, Northern Alberta, includes the North Pole, and we have patients that literally the sled dog, like, oh, Santa's elves, they're my patients. So, but, you know, if we may have multiple routes of transport, some sort of ground, skidoo, dog sled, some sort of thing, to a plane, to another plane, to a helicopter, and we can literally have 18, 24, 36-hour transfers. So how do we look at what's their physiology by the time they're in a center where they can actually get products? And what, you know, how does that impact their care? And are we past the point of no return ever? Is it always earlier is better? And I mean, shout out to my colleague, Matt Strickland. And today we were actually talking about the term the ultra transfer, because there was a session today about the 6 hour time. And people were talking about how that was a big deal in Virginia. And we're kind of like, 6 hours. Oh, man, if we get them in 6 hours, this is fantastic. You know, we have patients that come in from so far away. So, you know, what is that litmus test? What's the cutoff time? And is earlier always better? Is there a point of no return? Did the patient's physiologist declare itself where we say, hey, if you get to us, didn't really matter if we did it or not. And I think, you know, there's a different patient population of the urban trauma versus this rural transfer, and how do we actually optimize care for these patients, and how do we get the things to them that they need, and whether it's TXA blood, whatever, how do we actually get the right things to the right patients?
A couple of things. I just want to echo that what Josh and Neil said, the primacy of time. I think time to resuscitation is probably more important than ratios, and I think time to hemorrhage control is really the biggest issue. You mentioned prothrombin complex concentrates and what the role of those are in trauma, and I think, you know, from my perspective, I think those Kcentra or Berryplex probably has a role. Once hemorrhage control is achieved and you're playing catch-up, nonetheless, there's a huge study that's about to start, 8,000 patients, and that involves giving Kcentra or Berryplex versus placebo on the front end before hemorrhage control. So we'll see. We'll see if it makes a difference. It's going to be a massive study. It's a three-year study, so we won't have an answer for a few years, but there's 120 centers participating. Pretty much every big trauma center in the U.S. is participating. So I think that will be very interesting to see if that shows a role for PCCs.
I would love to know that, to say when I get a call from someone who's thousands of miles away from me or thousands of, you know, kilometers away from me, can I say, hey, do you have Kcentra? Do you have PCC at your site? Can you give them something like that? Can you give them TXA? And then we'll see if we can staunch the bleeding until they can actually get to a definitive care. So I think this the use of these concentrates is going to be really exciting for pre-hospital use when we have these rural, urban, austere environments, ultra transfer times, and see if this is going to help people.
Cotton really wants the microphone, but I'm not going to give it to him. So, I mean, with the concentrates, There's the first two trial that's going on, certainly within North America. So we'll see, industry sponsored, whatever, but we'll see how that plays out. Part of this, you know, we talk so much about the minutia all the time. What about this? What about that? We all know we can stand at the end of the bed in the ICU. We can look at a patient and we can say, we can turn up their PEEP. We can turn down their oxygen. We can do this. We can give them a little fluid. We can hold it back. It's not going to make a fucking difference. Really, the end of the bed, less is best. And a lot of this, we can evaluate everything all the time. And it's not really going to change. We're going to think, I have done the best research. I've saved all these lives. When basically, I need to give them blood. I need to stop the bleeding. And we're done. So, I mean, I love what's going on. I love how we do all this. We see all this. And there's, you know, there's this whole, I think there's a whole school of thought, maybe just getting jaded, but the whole school of thought of really all of this, the research that we look into all the time that looks amazing. And I'm just saying, I'm not sure.
All right. I want to start with, first of all, I'm going to try to interpret the kilometer thing that Nora was talking about. They bust our balls in Canada and Europe about the metric system. We use the metric system here. Anyway, I do want to chime in. Actually, what that was just off of Dory's thing, but what Jordan said was perfect. We're involved with the K-Center trial. I'm fully supportive of it. I just wish the quote control arm was plasma, because my bias, my argument is not that PCC sucks. It's just the volume that has to go with that, I think, is a big goddamn deal. Buffering capacity, acid base, all that kind of stuff. Again, you're talking about citrate, all the stuff we talked about with the ionized calcium, and your volume expander, your oncotic, your endothelial stabilizer. There's no doubt that PCCs have a better profile from a hemostasis standpoint, but all the other stuff in a bleeding to death trauma patient might benefit from that versus plasma needs to be decided, not that versus placebo. So that's my bias on that. So Chris Pratt's doppelganger is going to chime in again.
Yeah, I think some of the stuff that we've seen come out of the PAMPER study, you know, when we looked at the biomarkers we collected, it really was the patients that had endotheliopathy. And so I think if that is really what you target, and plasma does that, and I'm not sure that PCC does. So I think the endotheliopathy, you know, and if we can look at that, if that's going to be part of the trial, I think that's really important, because you know we've shown that plasma really principally works in the endotheliopathy, and correcting that and the expansion is really where we saw the bang for our buck. And so if we can show that in PCC, and if that makes a difference, great. If not, then I think you know we really know why plasma works, and then we can start to look at things like freeze-dried plasma, you know, and make that, you know, I can put, you know, a vial of that and reconstitute it in the back of my Jeep.
Right.
Right. That, you know, that becomes, you know, going from something that's like a critical care intervention on an air medical transport platform to, you know, I put it in the back of my first aid kit and carry a vial and reconstitute that, and I give it to somebody on the side of the road that I drive up on.
Do you carry pelvic binders and tourniquets in your car?
I have tourniquets and chest darts in my car.
Do you have a Robolus in your truck?
There is no Robolus in the back of my car. There's a scalpel for a roadside thoracotomy.
Yeah. I had my car.
Roadside thoracotomy. The day that Brian Cotton went to war with the entire fucking continent of Europe.
My car got broken into my building, and they popped my console, and there were three things in my console. There was hand cream, a lip balm, and a scalpel. And they left it on. And they left it on my seat. They did not steal my scalpel.
I have a question. What was the best bourbon tonight?
I know mine.
Yeah.
All right. So the best one actually is already long gone. It was the Private Select Maker's Pick. So Maker's Mark, I know people are like, Maker's Mark, Green Goblin uses it in Spider-Man. However, Well, he did. No, he did. If you go back and look at the original like Spider-Man movies, Green Goblin, yeah, he's got the maker's mark. Like my kids, like we go, oh, Spider-Man's bourbon, right?
Daddy's bourbon.
Daddy's perfect. A long time ago in the galaxy far, far away. But no, the best one was the, it was a local Benny's. Benny's Liquor in Chicago did a state profile. Hold on. Oh shit, it's a gift pack pick.
The real question is it French Mocha or French Mendes?
Oh, Josh Brown knows what the fuck he's talking about. All right, so it was, again, it was a private select from Benny's. But it was fantastic. Now, that said, I'm going to tell you, Dennis Kim listeners, and maybe you have it in Canada, best bourbon on the shelf that's not like, oh, my God, special in the back that you got to, like, give a handy for or, like, pay extra for it, is Old Forester 1920. I received no money from them, but I give them a lot of my goddamn money. Old Forester 1920 Prohibition style is the best one on the – and that was the winner for me tonight, minus this Maker's Mark pick, which I geek out about store picks. So, yeah. There you go, Dennis.
1920s Forester and hanging out with friends and colleagues from across the world at AAST in Chicago 2022. I want to thank you so much for hanging out. This was a super fun episode. Just being able to sit down casually with friends and colleagues and talk all things trauma, as well as bourbon. If you like what you're listening to and you feel that this is of any educational or clinical value to you and your care of your patients on a day-to-day basis, please let us know, let the world know. Go visit Apple Podcasts, drop us a 5-star review, a kind comment, and be sure to share the show with your friends. Until next time, keep reading, stay safe, take care of yourselves and one another.